I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company, and I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. I've grabbed so many of Vincent K. McMahon's imaginary brass rings that it's finally dawned on me that they're just that. They're completely imaginary. The only thing that's real is me, and the fact that day in and day out, for almost 6 years, I have proved to everybody in the world that I am the best on this microphone, in that ring, even in commentary. Nobody can touch me.
Another wonderful episode of CMJew's Wrestling Reviews right here on the Absolution Network. I'm, of course, your best Jew in the world, CMJew, and it is great to be here tonight as on this episode we go back to what has been called the start of the Attitude Era for the WWE, that being WrestleMania 14. And for such a tremendous pay-per-view, I had yet another guest to join me to have fun with. And tonight, I brought an old high school buddy with me. Who, literally, we're buddies. Literally, my mom would give him a ride along with me to high school. And he's seen me at my worst, so he could tell stories, too.
Absolutely. It's definitely a pleasure to be on and discuss, like you said, what was pretty well the start of the Attitude Era, as well as really, as JR put it, the Austin Era in the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah. By the way, I didn't say your name, so people, I apologize. Chris Wilson. Corey Wilson.
Almost. Corey Wilson.
Look, I'm going to inform you of something. There is a long-standing tradition on this podcast that I butcher everybody's name.
Hey, that's all right. That works for me. Sometimes I actually do it on purpose just to test people to see if they're actually listening. So I'm all for it.
Yeah. So Corey's with us. Corey really is a long time friend. He used to live a couple doors down from me. Did we live in the same apartment? It's been so long. I've forgotten the old apartment.
You know, I don't think we did, no, actually. I know that we did used to go in our summers. We used to go to summer camp together I guess that would have been maybe 1996, 1997?
Yeah. We went to Art Club, right?
Yeah, Art Club, that's right.
Oh, yeah, Art Club, yeah. Yep. Old Art Club, yes. At Walsingham Elementary.
Yes. Yeah. A bunch of little hyped up little brats running around, getting taken care of by underpaid workers. That was a great time.
Yep, in a elementary school field that was huge, and next to something Village, Enterprise Village.
Enterprise Village, yes.
Oh God,
that was a field. That was a field trip favorite in those days for sure.
Back in the 90s, because you actually got money and you could buy McDonald's. And now yes. I actually work for McDonald's.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure my job was at Publix on that trip. I'm pretty sure. Good stuff.
Yes. Because it basically, for those who don't know, Enterprise Village was basically a place where schools took kids to learn how to work. I'm not kidding about this.
Yes, and it was also a lot of it. They also had a second add-on that was called Finance Park, where they taught kids about budgeting their money and, you know, balancing a checkbook and all that good stuff. So yeah, you know, that was a common ground for us back in those days for sure.
And then, of course, we went to Great Osceola High School.
Yes, the Great Osceola High School. We are both class of 2004, I do believe.
Yes,
proud
we are.
Graduate.
You know, my mom still makes fun of the graduation speech.
Yeah.
No, she literally, because it's literally the same, because for 4 years, every time, because, you know, my sister, she went to Seminole. So every time we'd pass by Seminole, I'd flip it the bird. And she goes like, "You're the only person who does that. That rivalry isn't that big." Sure enough, come graduation, every one of our speakers, the greatest moment of the year was us beating Seminole.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. That was huge.
Oh, well, particularly for that year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In our senior year, I can remember a few years where we took it to them on the wrestling mats as well. I was a member of our high school's wrestling team for a few years, and those meets against Seminole High were always there was always a little bit of extra added incentive in there to get that big victory.
Yeah. Well, speaking of wrestling, that's what we're here to talk about tonight.
That's a fantastic segue.
Isn't it? I have a bit of practice of this thing.
Awesome.
You know, after a couple of years, it finally starts to click.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, we were talking. I mean, Corey, where did you start as a wrestling fan?
Well, my first exposure to pro wrestling was whenever I was about 5 years old, sometime in 1990. I was flipping through Saturday morning cartoons, and I happened upon Superstars of Wrestling, which was at the time Vince's weekly showcase for all his top talent to come out and basically brutalized jobbers, no-name complete scrubs who just got their ass handed to them week after week. And I think the first match that I actually saw was featuring the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And shortly after that, you know, I was one of those kids who played with G.I. Joes and all those other cool toys, and I remember going to the store with my great grandmother and seeing an Ultimate Warrior figure, and needless to say, from there on, I didn't play with G.I. Joes anymore. I was a wrestling nut from there on out, and I still am. I love everything about the pro wrestling game. I'm a big fan of the history, the behind the scenes aspects, and of course, you know, the day to day stuff that all of us see on TV. How about you, Tommy?
I started all the way back probably 1987 with WrestleMania 3. That's like the earliest match I can remember watching is WrestleMania 3.
Yeah.
And my father was, because this is back when we lived in California, I remember him taking me to the Anaheim Coliseum to watch Hogan face the Big Boss Man
in a
steel cage match. You remember that legendary steel cage match where Hogan... he missed his entrance mark, and they had to play it again?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure that I do remember from the Coliseum videotapes back in those days, I do remember a Boss Man versus Hogan steel cage match, which I think was right around, probably around 88, maybe early 89, where Hogan actually gave Boss Man a superplex, I'm pretty sure off of the cage, and it was... I mean, at the time, I remember just thinking, oh, my God, that ring, Boss Man's going to go through the ring. He's huge. You know, this is, of course, five-year-old Mark Corey talking. But I'm not sure if that was the same match, but I definitely do remember a few of those matches.
It is.
Boss Man and Hogan going around the horn.
Yep, it is, and that I was at that match. I was at that wrestling event.
Awesome.
And that's... still to this day, the only wrestling event I've actually ever been to, unfortunately. I tried as much as I could to go to last year's WrestleMania because I live up in New Jersey now, and it just didn't fall through. And it's like,
Well, I was fortunate enough back whenever they had the first WrestleMania in Florida, 24 in Orlando. I had a ticket. A bunch of friends of mine went, but I could not get a ride from Tampa to Orlando. So I ended up missing that one. But a few years ago, whenever they had WrestleMania 28 in Miami, I managed to get invited to go with a good friend of mine, Jack. We spent the whole weekend down there just marking out all weekend, man. I had a chance to meet a few legends at the Deauville Hotel on Miami Beach.
Yep.
Guys like the Iron Sheik, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Brutus Beefcake. I even saw Lex Luger walking around. So yeah, man, it's definitely an experience, you know, as we go back here and we're going to review WrestleMania 14. 28 was definitely an experience. And if there are any, you know, which of course I'm sure there are, wrestling fans listening to this, if you're a true fan of the sport, you owe it to yourself to make that trip and go to WrestleMania. It is literally,
once in your life.
Like they say, it's once in a lifetime. The granddaddy of them all. It does not get any bigger or any better than WrestleMania.
Yeah, I agree. And I, by the way, I see you're learning from the master and segueing. I'm glad that you're learning.
Yes, the force is strong with this one.
Unfortunately, that's not quite the WrestleMania I wanted to segue into. I actually wanted to segue to this year's WrestleMania, since you brought WrestleMania. How are you feeling about this? How are you feeling about this year's WrestleMania right now?
Well, you know, right now, I think that they have done a fantastic job of pissing off all of these Smart Mark fans who have been pushing and pushing for Daniel Bryan to finally ascend and grab that that proverbial brass ring in the WWE Championship. And, you know, I think there was a certain point a few months ago where I thought, you know, they're just not going to give him that push. He's never going to get it. But I've realized now, which I should have realized all along, that this whole plan, I mean, it's all been by design. You know, they keep screwing Daniel Bryan. They keep pushing him down. But I think, to me, honestly, if the last thing we see on WrestleMania this year isn't Daniel Bryan holding both belts with the entire crowd going, yes, 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 there's going to be a freaking riot. I mean, that's just all there is to it.
Stole the word. I was going to say two things. One, I'm not saying it's right, but at the moment Triple H screwed Bryan at SummerSlam and Orton won the title, I knew, okay, this is a push towards WrestleMania.
Right.
I knew it all along. To quote an old WWE WrestleMania theme song from a couple years ago, it was written in the stars.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, I think they've done, a really great job of building that and getting the fans behind Daniel Bryan as the underdog or the, you know, the guy who keeps getting screwed over and really deserves it. And I think that we're going to see the culmination of about 9 months or maybe even really a year. I mean, I guess you could say that this whole Yes movement, it kind of started back at the WrestleMania I was just referring to in Miami at 28, whenever...
that was about 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago now.
It is a combination.
Absolutely, and, you know, I think it's been building. It's been a slow build since then. Daniel Bryan went through the period where he was tagged up with Kane as Team Hell No, and, you know, there was some comedy segments in there, and it was kind of funny, but the one constant has been that Daniel Bryan has been over since he debuted, almost.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that we're going to see at WrestleMania 30, Daniel Bryan. You know, I have a feeling that Triple H may weasel his way into that main event somehow and turn it into a fatal four-way.
Of course.
I have a sneaking suspicion that may happen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, other than that, I'm also looking forward to Lesnar and Taker. I think that, you know, if there's one person who could come out there at WrestleMania and just grab a hold on The Undertaker and choke his ass out, take him to the mat, and just legit kick his ass, there's only one person, I think, who can do that, and that's Brock Lesnar. Now, granted, of course, I'm sure the police and security might have something to do with that, but it's kind of, to me, that's part of the appeal of this match. Brock Lesnar is an animal. As I'm sure another superstar or manager personality has pointed out many times, and Paul Heyman. Lesnar is a NCAA champion. He's a WWE champion. He's a former UFC champion. I mean, the guy is a machine. And, I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. The Undertaker, while he is still definitely, to me, the biggest draw in the company, and he's the one guy who can come out once a year and just put on that big spectacle and that one awesome performance to keep the people coming back year after year. You know, to me, that's the whole appeal of it, is that we're seeing pretty much the best athlete in the game right now, save for maybe Kurt Angle, going up against a true legend. I mean, you can take the WrestleMania streak aside. You can take all that stuff away, all the titles. Undertaker has been on top since 1991. And I don't think, I mean, he had a few runs where, you know, he went after the hardcore title and stuff like that. But for the most part, Undertaker has had a run like nobody else. The only person I can even compare it to would be Ric Flair, as far as longevity on top. So
yeah, well, to move on though a bit, just to answer two things. You said the riot if Daniel Bryan isn't a champion. It's not going to be a riot. It's going to be an apocalyptic war zone.
Yes,
if he doesn't win.
I think you're right. Absolutely.
But no, Undertaker just good match. I'm looking forward to Cena versus Wyatt because I think that's going to steal the show this year. A lot of people are saying that too, but I really think that.
I agree. You know, I think Bray Wyatt is probably the best developed character in the it's not called the Federation anymore, in WWE right now. You know, I think Bray Wyatt is the guy, and I was asked a few weeks ago, actually on another podcast, who I thought, if there was anybody in the company right now who could legitimately break the streak and carry on in some roundabout way the legacy of The Undertaker as being that guy, that having that mystique and that aura about him. And the only person that I could really see doing it is Bray Wyatt. You know, they put a lot into him here over this last year, which should be a testament to Bray Wyatt himself.
I disagree with that just a little bit, because I think Cena would be that one. And I've always argued this, that, you know, he's the one, not only can he carry the streak, it would legitimize his legacy, make him different from Austin and Hogan. And yet at the same time, he's somebody who's still going to probably be wrestling for another 10 years and can carry that. And it makes it that anytime anybody beats him, they automatically become legitimized.
You know, that definitely a good point you bring up there. To me, the only thing is about that is I think if you're going to legitimize somebody like that, I personally would do it with somebody that's younger. John Cena, I mean, let's face it, he's been the guy for the company for quite a long time. I think he's pretty well established, to be honest with you. And to me, if anybody was going to break the streak, I think it should be somebody young, up and coming, who, you know, shows a lot of promise and somebody that Vince McMahon and Stephanie and Triple H plan on putting a lot of stock into. And, I could definitely see that happening. But to me, I think as far as making it a better move for the future, I think Bray Wyatt would be the best call.
Yeah. Well, something that, you know, really helped cemented the future was the Attitude Era. And the Attitude Era started in today's topic, WrestleMania 14. There's
I agree. To me, WrestleMania 14 was really the kickoff of everything. Served as the springboard to put Steve Austin on top.
Yeah.
But you know, your point about that being the start of the Attitude Era, just a quick note, to me, the start of the Attitude Era came sometime right around the summer of 97.
A good point. Yeah, it is. You know, for a lot of people, argue that, around the time of, what was it? It was a European pay-per-view, wasn't it?
I think the one you're thinking of is One Night Only, where Shawn faced the British Bulldog for the European Championship.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, I think it was right around the time that Bret Hart turned heel and reformed the Hart Foundation, and mm-hmm. he started playing up the U.S. versus Canada thing. Between that, Shawn Michaels being brash and arrogant and...
forming DX really, with Triple H.
Yeah, and, at that time, Shawn was, from what I understand, a real pain in the ass to deal with backstage for Vince McMahon. So, I think all of those things, it was kind of the perfect storm, which, of course, you have to mention ECW being a huge up-and-coming promotion at the time, having...
Oh, absolutely.
At least some kind of influence. But, to me...
there's a sign in this pay-per-view that says, Mr. Monday Night RVD.
I actually noticed that earlier whenever I was watching it. Somebody pulls it up real quick and then folds it right back up, I guess in an attempt to keep Vince's lackeys, his little monkeys, from coming and taking his sign.
There's, the official start, but as far as, the pay-per-view to where it felt, because, again, you had DX and you had other members, I think a lot of people, the really headstone and the face, to say, of the Attitude Era was Austin, and him winning the title, the start of the Austin Era. So a lot of people, the Attitude Era, to an extent, really kicking off there, though it started in other places.
I agree with
that. So... you have WrestleMania 14, and let's tell the tale of the tape. WrestleMania 14 was on March 29th, 1998, with an attendance of 19,028 at the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts.
That's right.
A long way from WrestleMania 3 and the crowd of 91,000.
Yes, at the Pontiac Silverdome, absolutely.
I mean, it's just... I think that's one of the awesome things of this era is that they did WrestleMania and a lot of these pay-per-views in smaller venues than they did when they started out. Because when you think about, you think about WrestleMania 3 and you think of WrestleMania 4, which was in the Trump Towers, 4 and 5, for that matter. You think of 6 in Toronto, Skydome. So
And then also WrestleMania 8 in the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis.
Yep.
That was a pretty big one.
WrestleMania 9 in Las Vegas outside.
And then
starting with 10, it seemed like for the next pretty much almost 10 years, they were in smaller venues. Really, actually, up until WrestleMania 19. Astrodome?
17. I'm pretty sure 17 was at the Astrodome, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I think I said 19 by mistake. I meant to say 16. 16 was in Anaheim, which at the Pond, which was a much bigger venue. And that's when they started going back to bigger venues. So this is an interesting... time to where they were playing smaller venues for WrestleMania, which is, to an extent, really strange to see.
Yeah, at the time, right around WrestleMania 10, which was, if I'm not mistaken, 1994, the company kind of found themselves in the post-Hogan hangover period. Business was down, the crowds were down on the road at the house shows, and I think that WrestleMania kind of got scaled back at the time. They actually ran WrestleMania 11 in Hartford, Connecticut. right in their own backyard. And then, of course, the year after at the Anaheim Pond, and 13 was in Chicago at the Rosemont. But, there for quite a few years, really up until the Attitude Era took off with WrestleMania 14, as we're discussing today. WrestleMania was in a lot smaller venues, and it was definitely not quite as large of a spectacle as it is today.
Yeah. It's right, because this was the first time I ever saw WrestleMania 14, because, again, to go quickly, I was basically a wrestling fan up until 96, till Hogan started the NWO. I didn't like the NWO, which I know is strange to hear, because so many people did like it, but that turned me off, and I just, to an extent, quit wrestling until I saw Hogan came back in the summer of 99 with the yellow and red. And that got me back. And then I saw, oh, hey, there's this thing called SmackDown. The WWF. Oh, I haven't seen that in years. And I started watching SmackDown. And I've basically been watching wrestling again ever since then. So, but to go down, you have, by the way, you have Chris Warren and the DX Band opening the show off the air.
I'm so glad that you mentioned this. Go ahead and tell our listeners the atrocity that the Chris Warren DX Band committed.
Before the show?
Yes. Go ahead and
pull them in. Yeah. They sung America the Beautiful and the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah. I guess you could say they sang it. Needless to say...
I haven't seen it.
I did see it. If I'm not mistaken, it was included at the time on the first home video release of WrestleMania 14.
I watched it on the WWE Network and it didn't have it. They just went like straight into the pay-per-view.
Yeah, apparently, from what I understand and from what I can remember, it was awful. They got a standing ovation of boos. The Boston crowd really didn't like it, from what I understand. So that was an interesting start to WrestleMania that definitely paled in comparison to greats like Ray Charles at WrestleMania 2 doing America the Beautiful, Aretha Franklin at 3, so on and so forth. This was probably next, and I'm saying this as a Motorhead fan, this was probably the worst performance at a WrestleMania next to Motorhead.
Well, which Motorhead? Well, I think there's been several, hasn't there? In several Motorhead performances?
The first one was the one that I was mostly referring to. It seemed like the lead singer and bass player, Lemmy, maybe he had had a few Jack and Cokes before that, and just wasn't quite up to performing standards, really, as compared to what I've seen, as I said, as a Motorhead fan. But, Chris Warren and the DX Band, wow.
Is it as bad as the atrocity of Mean Gene Okerlund at the very first WrestleMania?
That's
a good question, isn't it?
That's a great question. I actually understand that Gene was fancied himself as a bit of a singer at one time. I can remember seeing a clip of him performing Tutti Frutti with Hulk Hogan on bass, which is a real hoot if you guys want to track it down out there. I'm sure it's on YouTube.
Have you seen him sing at WrestleMania 1?
Yeah, actually I did. He did America the Beautiful as well, didn't he?
Yeah. No, I think he only did the Star Spangled Banner. I talked about this with my friend Colleen on the last podcast, like, oh my god, it was awful. When you're basically singing it and then you bring, like, everybody sing with me! It's like, what?
Yeah, I'm sure much like Lemmy, Gene probably had a little
had
bit of sauce before here. Yeah, probably so.
But, I mean, this was the 80s, so I'm sure. But again, back to the show, your commentators for the evening are Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler. Of course, you have your Spanish announce table crew, who's... In about 5 more seconds, their table will be destroyed, as is the norm of the Attitude Era. And, of course, your ring announcer was Howard Finkel.
The Fink. Yes.
And our first match of the night featured LOD 2000 of Hawk and Animal with Sonny looking round.
The newly debuting LOD 2000. At the time, they were actually billed as the Mystery Entrance.
Yes, they were. The new Midnight Express of Bombastic Bob, who, if I do believe that, that's Bob Holly, isn't it?
That's Spaceman Bob Holly. You got it.
Yep. Bodacious Bart with Jim Cornette. And let me run down the teams here. Los Brocris of Savo Vega and Miguel
Boricua.
Perez. Yep.
Los Boricuas. Savio Vega and Miguel Perez. And I believe they actually, the other two members of Los Boricuas were also in the Battle Royal, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, they were. Jose Estrada Jr. and Jesus Castillo. The Truth Commission of Recon and Sniper. Bradshaw and Chains. The Nation of Domination team of both Mark Henry and D'Lo Brown and of Farouk and Kama Mustafa, who would later become the Godfather, thank God. The Quebecers. you do not know how, not this last year's wrestling, but the WrestleMania before, when Godfather came out. That was my moment of the night.
With D'Lo, who was it? With D'Lo Brown and... who was it?
Godfather came out with the Ho Train at the Royal Rumble 2 years ago.
Oh, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember that. That was the crowd seemed to love that as always.
Oh yes, but you have the Quebecers as of Jacques Rizzo and Pierre Ouellette, the Rock and Roll Express of Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, the Headbangers of Amash and Thrasher. Yep. The team of Too Much, featuring Scott Taylor and Brian Christopher. The Disciples of the Apocalypse of 8-Ball and Skull. Steve Blackman and Flash Funk, a.k.a. Too Cool Scorpio. And the Goodwins of Phineas and Henry.
Yep. Phineas I and Henry O. Godwin. Pig and Hog.
Mm-hmm. This is the first. It's a 15-team battle royal to determine the number one contender for the WWF Tag Team Championship of the World.
Yep, and the winners would get their shot at Unforgiven coming up the next pay per view.
Yep. So, what did you think of this match? I mean, of course we're going to spoil it. LOD won.
Surprise, surprise. The returning LOD 2000 with new manager and eye candy Sonny. Pretty well dominated the match. It was a pretty standard battle royal. You had a few small storyline things go on. Kurgan, who was previously a member of the Truth Commission, came in and he attacked Sniper and Recon. And then, of course, at the time we had Jim Cornette leading the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance, resurgence in the Federation, and one of his representatives came out, Barry Windham, former NWA champion and WCW standout. He was also a WWF Tag Team Champion at WrestleMania 1. He came out and eliminated Chains from DOA, and that was basically to get back at Barry Windham's ex-partner in the New Blackjacks, one Bradshaw.
Yeah.
And, you know, pretty much it was all pretty standard. They just, you know, the rules, of course, were, as in most tag team battle royals, that if one partner is eliminated, the other one has to leave the ring as well.
Yep.
And so, it just basically got whittled down the two teams. There was the New Midnight Express of Bombastic Bart and Bodacious Bob. I could puke just saying those names. They basically
let's just call it the man who is yet to be known as Hardcore Holly.
Yes,
and leave it at that.
Yes, he definitely got a few crappy hands as far as that goes. It's kind of hard to top Thurman Sparky Plug, but I think Bombastic Bob or Bodacious Bob or whatever the hell his name was, that almost pretty well topped Sparky Plug. But basically, towards the end of the match, the New Midnight Express, the whole premise was they were trying to keep Animal, who had got knocked out of the ring after being attacked by the Godwins after they were eliminated. the New Midnights, they basically just double-teamed Hawk and tried to keep Animal out of the ring. And shortly thereafter, once Animal got back in, he fed Bob and Bart their lunch, kicked their ass, and tossed them right out. And that was the launching pad for LOD 2000 with Sonny, which didn't necessarily take off like I think they hoped it would.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what would happen after this. I'll have to go and watch it. But it, it's more, from my perspective, it was a thing to win. It was an okay match. It was a decent start. I mean,
yeah.
It was a 15-man battle royal. It's a decent start to WrestleMania. It's a building match. You know, it's a match that has some spots in it, but it's just to build the audience and get them, you know, okay, started, and here we go.
It was just the appetizer, and I think it served pretty well as a, you know, it served its purpose, and pretty standard tag team battle royal fare. Nothing special here, nothing to write home about.
Yeah, which brings us to a match I think we're both fans of, and that is Taka Michinoku versus Anguilla, a.k.a. the man who will later be known as S.A. Rios, for the WWF Light Heavyweight Championship of the World.
That's right. And this was actually the only time that title was defended at WrestleMania. The Cruiserweight title, of course, was defended a couple times in a Battle Royal and a few other matches at WrestleMania to come. But this was still early in the creation of the Light Heavyweight Championship. Of course, they had the tournament for that title in late 1997. And, I thought it was a great match, a good junior heavyweight, cruiserweight match. Aguila was fantastic. He hit a lot of really cool dives. Taka also was hitting a lot of really cool high-impact, high-energy moves. And it was back and forth. It was a typical Japanese-Mexican-style junior heavyweight match, and it was really entertaining. Honestly, to me, it was one of my favorite matches on the card.
I mean, it's either my third or fourth favorite match of the card. I'll go with third favorite. It was just a really, really good match. A lot of spots. It's just great seeing all the dive moves and everything. It, like you said, great sort of cruiserweight style. Lucha Libre versus Japanese strong style type of wrestling.
I think that at the time the light heavyweight championship being brought to the table in the Federation, that was sort of an answer to what WCW was doing at the time with the cruiserweights, with guys like Mysterio, Psicosis, Juventud. I mean, those guys, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, all those guys were putting on clinics every week on Nitro. And I think pretty much that was the whole light heavyweight division was, in theory, an answer to that. And, this match at WrestleMania was one of those few matches, to me, in their light heavyweight division that sort of lived up to the same things that the WCW was doing with the cruiserweight division.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the best part of WCW I found when I was watching it in the early days was the cruiserweight matches. I found them to be absolutely incredible. And this is definitely was an attempt to cash in on that until they would put the light heavyweight championship around Goldberg, which is a whole different story.
Yes.
It was a great match, and I do like this. I like the fact that Michinoku kept going for that moonsault, and he kept missing, and finally hit it, and that was sort of the setup for the ending of the match to come. So, some great spots.
That was the setup for the Michinoku driver finisher.
Yep. And, I mean, to this day, that driver is still a legendary maneuver that everybody loves seeing. I mean, you got Luke Harper who does it now.
Oh, that's right. He does, yeah.
Yes. But then we go on to our next match, and this is the match I think I will sit here and say was my second favorite match of the night. Owen Hart versus the champion, the European WWF European champion, Triple H with China, for the WWF European Championship. And in this match, China must be handcuffed to Commissioner Sergeant Slaughter.
That's right. Yeah, Owen Hart had captured the European title, I think a month or two before this. And the way he won it was Triple H had Goldust dress up as Triple H. And in some way to get out of fighting Owen Hart for the title. And Owen Hart beat him and, of course, thought that he won the European title until Triple H came out and said, well, you know, that's not me. But Commissioner Slaughter thought it was such a convincing ruse that he went ahead and awarded the title to Owen. And so after that, a few weeks later, Owen had injured his ankle in some form. And Triple H basically goaded Owen Hart into getting in the ring and defending that European title about 2 weeks before WrestleMania on Raw.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's why Triple H went into this match as the champion. And as you said, the stipulation was that China would be handcuffed to Commissioner Slaughter. And, of course, yeah, you know, the match started off with Slaughter trying to convince China to get in the handcuffs, which...
Which, by the way, there are a lot of people that, you know, sort of bank on China as a beautiful woman. I disagree.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sure she's a nice lady. I'll just leave it at that. I was raised to where if I don't have anything nice to say, don't say much at all. So
Must everybody hate her because of her current occupation?
Yeah, you know, to me, what she does now is kind of irrelevant to me, but at the time, you know, China came up through Killer Kowalski School, much like Triple H. So she came into the business the right way, but I think that once she kind of got pushed as the face of the women's division there for a while, right around like WrestleMania 2000 or WrestleMania 17, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I think it, from what I understand, it kind of went to her head, and she got a bit of an attitude, and that was pretty much her undoing. But, of course, China is not our main focus here. Our main focus is the match Triple H and Owen.
Yes, which was awesome. I mean, it was a great back-and-forth match. I mean, to the flow. I mean, it's one of my second favorite match. It was the flow, the ebb and flow of the match was wonderful. And just great maneuvers. And just some of the storytelling, like early in the match, Owen hits the Hurricane Rana on Triple H. Great.
Yes.
Later in the match, he goes for another Hurricane Rana. Triple H counters it into a powerbomb. That's just great storytelling right there. I like the finish, which is that, you know, oh, China's handcuffed. She can't do anything. She throws baby powder in Slaughter's eyes and is able to trick Owen Hart. Allows for the low blow, the roll up, and the win.
Yep. That was the big screw job. They got one over on Owen again. If I'm not mistaken, this wasn't the last time that Triple H and Owen faced off.
No, I
think they had a few other matches, but you know, I always thought that right around this time, a lot of the European and Intercontinental Division matches and feuds. You know, you had Triple H and Owen Hart. Another match we're going to get to, The Rock and Ken Shamrock. You know, pretty much all of those four guys that I mentioned at the time there for about a year or two, they could work with any combination of them. And I just remember all of those matches being pretty good. Shamrock and Owen, Shamrock and Triple H, you know, Triple H and The Rock and Owen, all those matches were all pretty good. And, you know, I think at the time those were pretty much the workhorses of the Federation at the time.
Oh, yeah. But, like I said, great ebb and flow. Just a great match.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Owen Hart had a leg injury that, of course, cost him the European title after he decided to defend it on Raw, and that was sort of the point of Triple H's attack, was to go after that weak leg. And that, you know, that provided for some great storytelling, old school classic wrestling where you pick up a limb and wear it down, and that, you know, that tells the story. And, of course, as you said, China took out the infamous white powder, the white mysterious powder, and threw it in Slaughter's face and low-blowed Owen, and that allowed Triple H to hit his pedigree finisher and retain his coveted European championship.
Yeah. And then we move on to a match that actually surprised me. It's not one of my favorites. To an extent, it's actually one of the worst, if not the worst match on the card.
I think I'd have to agree.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those things where when you're talking about a WrestleMania match, you know, worst match of the WrestleMania card is usually like one of the better matches of any other card at any other promotion.
Right.
But in this case, it's a match that did surprise me. It was a mixed tag team match featuring Mark Mero and the Lovely Sable versus the Artist, formerly known as Goldust, and Luna. And
yeah,
I say this because Mark Mero was sloppy in this match, Goldust was sloppy, Luna was sloppy. Sable shocked me with how good she was. She carried this match.
She really did. I think pretty much she was the attraction for this match. Obviously, the big draw was to see Sable get in the ring and finally get her revenge on Luna, who had been between her and Goldust and Mark Mero, basically making Sable's life a living hell for a few weeks. The whole story was that Sable was becoming more of a star than her her
husband.
Protege and real-life husband at the time, Mark Mero, and was sort of outshining him. And after Mark Mero came back from a, I believe, knee injury, you know, whenever he initially came in the Federation, he was a good guy or babyface, as they say, as the Wild Man, Mark Mero. And that was fresh off of his Johnny B. Badd WCW run. But he had a knee injury sometime around late 1997, and whenever he returned, he had a new look. They played up his boxing background, and he was a bad guy. And pretty much from there on, the whole storyline was that he was jealous of Sable's success. And this was basically, I wouldn't quite say it was the end to this storyline, because there was a lot more in the Mark Mero and Sable feud to come, but this was an intergender match, mixed tag team, as you said. Wasn't the best match ever, you know. Goldust, like you said, Goldust and Mero were sort of off. Luna, you know, she's a second generation worker, but in this one she was just pretty much going all over the place, being her usual wild self. So really this one was just kind of a catfight / brawl in many ways. Not a lot of scientific action. And the big moment, of course, was seeing Sable hit the powerbomb.
TKO. Well, the powerbomb and the TKO.
And then, of course, the Mark Mero's finisher, the TKO, which she didn't do too bad as far as hitting it. JR and the King sold it like death. But, you know, I mean, that was, the crowd seemed to pop for it, and they were all for Sable. So, you know, while it might not have been a great match, there was definitely a draw there, or maybe a couple of draws in Sable.
I mean, that's something we haven't really touched on is, you know, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, they've been doing a pretty good job up to this point of talking about the match.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, all the matches for that matter. Up to this point, the big highlight of my Jim Ross highlight was him telling, call Logan Airport and tell him that's not an airplane, that's the light heavyweight champion.
Yeah, Jim, you know, it was kind of funny to hear him call some of those moves in the light heavyweight match, because you could almost hear him pause, and he kind of does a little check with himself to make sure that he's calling the move right, unlike his counterpart in WCW, Tony Schiavone at the time, who would call he would call everything a plancha or a moonsault or whatever. He didn't care to learn. But I mean, you definitely made a good point there. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler definitely did a great job of hyping up the crowd, you know, not burning out the audience at home with too much. But they definitely, as always, enhanced what we viewed, for sure.
these messages. We'll be right back.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I am a terrible geek. I don't watch Doctor Who. I don't care for anime. I've never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I like Star Wars and Star Trek okay, but I've never really ventured far into the extended universes of either property. Hell, I have never even watched a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I have been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I have been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. To deal with this borderline personality disorder, I started a podcast in 2007 called
Views from Long Lost.
Every 2 weeks, or so, depending on real life, I pick a particular series, or issue, or character, or whatever to talk about, and then I talk about them, because that's kind of the point of a podcast. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I have a guest, like my semi-regular co-host, the irredeemable Shag, or my other semi-regular co-host, Thomas DJ, or with another friend from the podcasting world. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, and from there you can find the iTunes link, the email address, as well as the backlog of episodes.
Views from the Long Box.
A podcast about comics, or a desperate cry for help? You decide. Every other Tuesday, or so, depending on real life, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
Gathered together from the far reaches of the internet are assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
The Superman Fan Podcast,
Superman in the Bronze Age,
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast,
The Schuster Herald Podcast,
It's Superman,
The Carazeroth Podcast,
The Armature of Steel, a John Henry Allen podcast,
The World's Best Podcast,
and
Radio KAL from SupermanHomepage.com.
Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
Scott Gardner,
Sam Rizzo,
Danny Sapp,
Matthew Epps,
I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Yunus, and co-host Scotty V
at SupermanPodcastNetwork.com.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dad.
We need to record another new trailer.
Another one?
Yes. You know that we read comics and then talk about comics, because as we've established, talking about comics you've not read is just dumb.
Yeah, and you make me do it every Thursday.
Well, we've moved.
Have we?
Yes, we have outgrown our old location.
I don't feel like I've moved.
And we have now moved to twotruefreaks.com.
What was that again?
Twotruefreaks.com. Hey, Kids Comics. Still every Thursday at twotruefreaks.com.
Yeah, play it. Come on. Yeah, play it loud. Play it loud.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Illogic. Foolish emotions. A constant irritant.
And transpile out. Freak!
Two!
Along the circus. Right next to the dog-faced boy.
True!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh,
shit!
It's a super prize package worth $9,300.
This isn't the biggest bag over the head punch in the face I ever got. God damn it!
now!
Go away, Peyton!
And now, together by live simulation via the internet, your hosts, Scott Gardner.
He killed a police officer, for Christ's sake!
You're goddamn lucky he didn't kill all of them.
And Chris Honeywell.
Keep away! Keep away from me!
You are physically repulsive, intellectually retarded, vulgar, insensitive, selfish, stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
So you're looking at me?
Yeah, because she thought you're some kind of freak. Now come on,
hey,
let's God, go.
She likes me, eh?
No way.
Shut up, you freak! Julius, you... I say shut up! It's a man home! A man home!
TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Well, I bring... Well, actually, and we'll come back to them after the next match, because I think their highlight of their evening was a certain tag team match we'll get to in a couple of minutes. But our next match is The Rock... Ken Shamrock versus the champion, The Rock.
That's the people's champion to you.
Yeah. By the way, they had that little interview earlier in the WrestleMania. I'm like, what the hell? Like, and it was pretty funny. I mean, it was classic Rock, but it's like...
Yeah, yeah. You're, of course, referring to the Jennifer Flowers Rock interview, which Jennifer Flowers, if I'm not mistaken at the time, was involved in some sexual controversy with our president at the time, Bill Clinton. Of course, that wasn't the end of Bill Clinton's scandal there as far as that went.
Yeah,
President Clinton.
Yeah, President Clinton.
but yeah, you know, that was kind of the start of it. It was a hot-button topic, and that was pretty much the whole reason for them bringing in Jennifer Flowers. And then, of course, before the match started with Rock and Shamrock for the Intercontinental title, we had Double J, Jeff Jarrett, with his manager, Tennessee Lee, who introduced Jennifer Flowers, who served as the guest ring announcer.
Ring announcer. Yep.
Yes, yes.
Yes, but you had the Intercontinental Champion, The Rock, versus Ken Shamrock. Of course, The Rock came with Kama Mustafa, Mark Henry, and D'Lo Brown.
The Nation of Domination.
The Nation. We are the Nation of Domination.
Yes.
This is for the WWF Intercontinental Championship with the stipulation of if The Rock gets disqualified, he will lose the title to Ken Shamrock.
This
was a brutal, brutal match. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was a brutal match. I love seeing Ken Shamrock wrestle. He's great in the ring. And I really like the fit. I liked the finish. I liked how it set up storyline of him winning, but ultimately being disqualified because he wouldn't break the hold. Though I don't know why they just didn't disqualify him for like hitting the ref.
You know, I thought the finish was kind of screwy. I felt like they should have went ahead and gave Shamrock the title. But you know, like you said, they had kind of a screwy finish there. It was a real brawl. It was, you know, a lot of definite live rounds being thrown by Shamrock. The Rock got busted. I believe his lip got busted open at one point. And, of course, about midway through the match, getting towards the end, Farouk, who was originally the founder and leader of the Nation of Domination, came out while The Rock was stuck in the sharpshooter, the ankle lock.
The ankle lock.
Shamrock.
Yeah. That was at the end of the match.
That
was after the match, I mean.
Was it? Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, it was after the match, and like, he won't break the hold, and then here comes Farouk, and you know, you think Farouk's going to help him, and he doesn't.
Yep, basically what happened is first, the other members of the Nation of Domination, D'Lo and Mark Henry came in, and they all got belly-to-belly suplexes for their troubles, trying to get Shamrock off of the Rock. And, they all got the belly-to-belly suplex, and then we see Farouk, Ron Simmons, of course, come down to the ring. And we think that maybe he's going to help the Rock after the Rock has been lobbying for his position in the Nation of Domination as the new leader. And there was definitely a tease of that feud for quite a while. This was sort of the big blow-off where Farouk had had enough, and he finally he just left Rocky high and dry. And, of course, in the ankle lock from Ken Shamrock, who was at the time, like they called it, in the zone.
Well, they also called him, he also went by the world's most dangerous man, and I love that comment right before he goes backstage after the match by Jim Ross of, you know, he just showed that that moniker is not no gimmick.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah. Ken Shamrock was a legit fighter, of course, a early star in the UFC.
Back when the UFC was good.
Well, yeah, you know, that was back whenever it was a little bit less regulated and more of a real knockdown, drag-out brawl, the kind of thing you would see at a place like the famed Pier 6 that Jim Ross always talks about. I'd have no idea where that is, but
well,
I definitely don't want to go there.
I was a fan of the UFC back in its early days before it was like everybody did it, because that was the whole attraction to UFC was it's mixed martial arts. Everybody
Absolutely.
Is doing different styles. Now
Absolutely.
Everybody does Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and it almost seems like almost every match is just, as soon as one goes to the ground, if he's not knocked out, it goes to a guard, and it's this guard match. And it's just, to me, those are boring.
Well, you know, and as I said, at the time, the UFC was a lot less regulated. You would see guys that were 220 pounds taking on 400-pounders. And at the time, it was a one-night tournament format, unlike currently how they do it, where it's almost like a boxing card, where you have, you know, a fighter might have one fight every 4 to 6 months or so. In the early days of the UFC and Shamrock's heyday, it was a really brutal one-night tournament. And, you know, kudos to him for being such a decorated striker and grappler in his career. I was really surprised at how well Shamrock made the transition to the pro wrestling game. You know, I thought he did really good there for a few years, and this was one of his first big matches. Of course, the year prior to this, Shamrock was the special guest referee enforcer for the submission match between Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah. Which, again, and I still have to watch that WrestleMania for the first time, too. There it is, like, this list of WrestleManias I need to watch that I have not seen. Pretty much from 10 up to, oh, God, WrestleMania 20, actually. I mean, I've seen matches. I mean, even though I was watching wrestling, I didn't start ordering pay-per-views up until actually WrestleMania 21. So, And WrestleMania was like, it's the one pay-per-view I'll buy, along with the Royal Rumble. So,
that's definitely the case for me, even these days, you know. There's not a lot of pay-per-views. There's not a whole lot of pay-per-views that can make me get out my wallet and hit that order button on the on my cable provider. But WrestleMania and the Royal Rumble, of course, are always those events that can get me to do just that. But now, of course, with the advent of the WWE Network, you know, I may end up subscribing to that. I'm fortunate enough to have pretty much every TV show and pay-per-view from about 1984 till about 1999 or 2000 in the WWF at the time. So, to me, really, the network isn't much of a draw as far as watching old pay-per-views and footage. But there definitely is some draw there for the pay-per-views. You know, it's really a great deal if you're going to even order just one or two pay-per-views per year, like I do.
Yep.
You know, to go ahead and jump in with that six-month commitment. And I would definitely suggest going back and watching some of these old WrestleManias. Maybe for one or two of them, I can come back and join you, and we'll review another.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to our last three matches. And starting with, you know, as I may mention, Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler at their best.
Yeah.
We have Yeah, we Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie challenging the New Age Outlaws, the WWF Tag Team Champions of the World, in a dumpster match for the WWF Tag Team Championships. Now, the stipulation of a dumpster match is that the first team to put the entire team in a dumpster and to throw down the dumpster lids, essentially trapping them, will win the WWF Tag Team Championships.
Yes, and I believe that stipulation arose from a few months prior to that. I think it was shortly after the 1998 Rumble on Raw. The New Age Outlaws attacked Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie, a.k.a. Terry Funk, and actually knocked them out, put them in a dumpster, and then pushed them off of the stage, which I can recall at the time Jim Ross saying, "By God, he just fell 20 feet off that stage." I remember thinking, there's no way that's 20 feet. But either way, it basically served as... that whole moment basically served as the impetus to this, a first in the World Wrestling Federation at the time, a dumpster match.
Yeah. Well, even if it was 20 feet, do you forget there was the tables there that broke the fall?
Correct. Yeah.
I mean... if you know anything about movies, like, okay, that's where the thing was set for the fall, so it wouldn't hurt that much. Still probably hurt.
I can definitely remember about that segment where they did get pushed off the stage. I can remember them parading Sunny out there and getting her to fake cry and be concerned, to really sell it to the crowd that that these guys were really hurt and that this was a real heinous attack and... yeah, it definitely put over the Outlaws as the new kids on the block, to use a term.
That's not quite dated.
You know, they not quite dated. No, they had taken out the OLD, as they called them, in the Legion of Doom just before that, and of course they made their return early in the evening. But this was a continuation of the New Age Outlaws. Showing up the old guard and proving that they were on the scene and they were going to be dominant in the tag team division, which, surprisingly enough, they were for quite a few years there.
Yep. But, you know, it was a great match. Again, anytime watching Mick Foley or Terry Funk wrestle in a hardcore environment is always fun, especially during these years. To an extent, it was their prime as far as doing hardcore matches. And it just some brutal spots in this match.
Oh, yeah.
But the chair shots, the dive, I mean, the whole dive from the ladder.
The dive where Billy Gunn and Mick Foley go into the dumpster off of the ladder. Yeah, that was pretty brutal. There was, there was another bump that I noticed where Cactus, he did his flip-over dive, or at least attempted it.
And went into the dumpster,
And went into the dumpster, and man, that looked like it hurt like hell, I gotta say.
Oh. I mean, of course, anybody's thinking like, oh my God, how can he put his body on the line like that? I kept thinking, wait about 9 months for King of the Ring, or should I say, about 4 or 5 months for King of the Ring.
this was, of course, prior to that famous... Undertaker, Mankind, Hell in a Cell, where he took that huge, huge bump off the top through the table and then actually through the cell into the ring. And that's a whole other can of worms there that I think you should definitely cover at some point down the road.
Oh, trust me, I've seen that match, and my plan is to cover that King of the Ring. It's going to be King of the Ring all June. I'm telling you this right now.
Fantastic.
So that pay-per-view in particular will be covered.
Awesome.
But yeah, great match, and I love the finish.
Anytime
you bring a forklift into any situation, it's awesome.
Yes, definitely. of course, the finish was Cactus, Chainsaw, and the Outlaws. They brawled to the back, and Cactus Jack.
And there was another dumpster.
Yep, there was another dumpster. Cactus Jack sort of took over the assault there and hit them with a chair, each of them, and winded up putting Billy Gunn and the Road Dog on a pallet, a wooden pallet, that was, of course, then picked up by the I'm certain not licensed to drive a forklift, Chainsaw Charlie, a.k.a. Terry Funk, who wheeled it right on over to a conveniently placed dumpster in the backstage area and dumped him right in it, and Cactus shut the lid, and of course that signaled the victory for the old age outlaws and Chainsaw Charlie and Cactus Jack Mick Foley.
Yes, yep. It's just a great sort of hardcore match, which I think another thing about this match that really worked is that you had mixed tag match, and then you had the Intercontinental match, which weren't the best of the evening. And so there was kind of a layover from that. This match got the adrenaline and got everybody excited. It got it all back up in great preparation for what the next match was.
Yeah, definitely.
Which we go to our next match. We have The Undertaker facing his brother Kane, who is with his father and mentor Paul Bearer. Of course, we should mention that before this match started, Pete Rose was apparently invited to the venue by, I guess, Jerry Lawler. And of course, what does Pete Rose do? He insults people from Boston.
Yes. Basically, Pete Rose came out and he insulted the people in Boston, as you said. He was certain to make mention of the famed curse of the Bambino that struck the Boston Red Sox for many years, until 2004 when they finally broke that streak. Pete Rose came out and he told Bill Buckner jokes, which of course the famed first baseman who cost the Boston Red Sox, I believe, the 86 championship or the World Series. I'm not sure which one it was.
And the World Series. That's one of my favorites. Like, you know, I put Bill Buckner's tickets on the ground, but he couldn't bend over to pick them up.
that was definitely some easy heat for Pete Rose, but to the delight of the Boston faithful, shortly thereafter, before Pete Rose can introduce Kane, comes out with Paul Bearer, as you stated, his legitimate, illegitimate father, whatever the hell it was. Came out, and apparently Kane is a Red Sox fan because he gave Pete Rose a little hand around the neck there, picked him up for a tombstone, and of course laid him out, which started a bit of a tradition for further WrestleManias, which I'm sure you'll get into as you go down
at
the
a
road
later
here
date.
Review a few more. Yes, and then of course we had another one of the awesome big spectacle Undertaker entrances. He came out with the druids with the torches, and it was a really cool visual, definitely, to see the Undertaker come down to the ring like that.
Yes, it was. And, of course, the year after this would be the Ministry, which would then later go to Badass, and we wouldn't see this sort of Undertaker, actually, until WrestleMania 20. So that's, I think, the interesting thing about this is that we wouldn't see this Undertaker, this was 14, so 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, for at least 6 years, we wouldn't see this Undertaker.
Yeah. Shortly after this, as you mentioned, Undertaker kind of went to the little bit more sadistic, satanic, almost Ministry persona. And then he was injured, of course, and came back as the American Badass on the bike with the trench coat and the bandana and all that good stuff. But this was a huge build-up. The build-up for this started earlier. In 1997, after, of course, Paul Bearer had turned his back on The Undertaker at SummerSlam 1996 and aligned with Mankind, as well as Vader, and, of course, Mankind and The Undertaker feuded. And in one of those matches, The Undertaker burned Paul Bearer with flash paper. And, of course, that led to Paul Bearer just being completely focused on gaining revenge against The Undertaker, and he came out on Raw and over a few weeks spilled the secret that The Undertaker had a brother, and that, of course, the story that the funeral home where The Undertaker and Kane's parents lived was burned down one night by Kane, who was playing with matches, as The Undertaker told it. and ended up killing their mother and father, and scarred Kane for life. He was burned, of course, in storyline, burned, horribly disfigured, and lived in some basement. I guess he lived in Paul Bearer's basement for like 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that Paul Bearer just kept him chained to a radiator and fed him maybe fish bones or something. And just let him know. Well, yeah, I mean, he basically had him around this whole time just waiting to for the moment whenever he knew The Undertaker would turn on him.
Yeah. I'll say this. I guess being chained to Paul Bearer's basement and getting fish bones is still a better gimmick than being Jerry Lawler's dentist. But
Oh, that's a great point you raised there. Definitely, definitely. A little Isaac Yankum BDS shout-out.
Yep. But, of course, you know, as you're alluding to, this all came to head at Bad Blood, and it was the first Hell in a Cell, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, absolutely, between the
Undertaker
champion at the time, Shawn Michaels, and The Undertaker.
And in the match, Kane comes out, ripped the door off the cell, tombstones his brother, which, of course, gives Shawn Michaels the win, which leads to this feud. Of course, they also double-cross him at the Royal Rumble in the casket match where they trap The Undertaker in and set the casket ablaze, thinking that they got rid of Taker, only for him to appear a couple of nights later on Raw. And, of course, that set everything in motion for this match. So, with that being said, let's get into the match. You know, it was a good match. It's probably my fourth best match of the night. In all honesty, it's just my issue with the match, I think, comes down to the ending. And I understand the whole story element of that it takes three tombstones to put Kane down. It's just the build up to them that wasn't there for me.
Yeah, you know, it was a pretty pretty back and forth. The Undertaker came out hard and heavy, taking it to Kane. Kane finally cut him off and started his assault. Of course, Kane and The Undertaker played up the fact that they were brothers and had the similar move sets with the with the top rope clothesline and the tombstone and the choke slam. And basically, as you said, it took three tombstones for The Undertaker to finally put Kane out. At the time, you know, you didn't see a lot of matches where guys would have to take multiple finishers to end the match. You know, the finisher was usually the signal that that's it. You know, you might see one or two kickouts in major matches like these, but to see three, and I believe he also hit a couple other moves in between, a leg drop and a clothesline maybe.
Yeah.
You know, it took all that to finally stop Kane, and which, of course, he did.
I like that, but I mean, just the thing of he hits a tombstone, he kicks out, so he hits a leg drop, waits for him to get up, does another tombstone, doesn't work, he kicks out, goes to the top rope, hits the top rope clothesline, goes for the tombstone again, then it works. It's just that I guess I would have liked to see more organic moves than just doing, hey, I'm going to do, I mean, what they should have done is they should have done like a leg drop and some other moves, then the second tombstone, then a couple more moves leading to the flying clothesline, and then the tombstone. Or what they should have done is, tombstone didn't work, well, let me pick him up again and hit it with him again. Didn't work, I'll do it one more time. It should have been done like that in those formats, rather than just the way it was, because it just seems like Taker didn't know what to do.
Yeah, you know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, this was one of the first times the Undertaker and Kane, it was the first time The Undertaker and Kane faced off, on TV or pay-per-view. As far as I can remember, unless maybe The Undertaker took on fake Diesel or Isaac Yankum somewhere along the way. The thing is, I think both of those guys, Undertaker and Kane, have a very similar style. They're all, obviously both about the same size, same build. And, of course, they were playing up the gimmick where they were brothers. So, like I mentioned, they had the similar move sets. To me, the match wasn't all that great. It served its purpose. It told a story. But to me, the main draw was to finally see The Undertaker get his revenge on his little brother. who had been making his life a living hell since the summer of the year before. And and of course, Undertaker finally got the victory. But after the match, Paul Bearer attacked the Undertaker, and Kane attacked him and hit him with a chair and then gave him a tombstone onto the chair. And once Kane and Paul Bearer left the Undertaker laying, of course, the Undertaker did his signature sit up and recover and left the ring, obviously signaling to us that this wasn't the last we had seen of the Undertaker versus Kane feud.
Absolutely. Which, of course, brings us to our main event of the evening, where we have Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Shawn Michaels, the WWF champion, with Triple H in China, for the WWF championship, with special guest outside enforcer Iron Mike Tyson.
Yes, yes. This match, you know, this main event was a long time coming. Of course, Shawn Michaels had recaptured the coveted WWF championship at Survivor Series the year before in November with the infamous Montreal Screwjob. Of course, Bret Hart left the company, went on to WCW. A whole other can of worms there for that story, but Michaels captured the belt at the Survivor Series, and he went on to defend it against Ken Shamrock in December at the Degeneration X In Your House pay-per-view, and then against The Undertaker, of course, as we mentioned, in a casket match at the 1998 Royal Rumble, and then for No Way Out 1998, the February pay-per-view, Michaels was going to be in an eight-man tag. But I guess his back issues or his other issues that he was having at the time prevented him from doing so. So basically, this was, as far as I know, Shawn Michaels' only match between the Rumble and WrestleMania, which, of course, would serve as his final match in the Federation for, I think, about 4 years. You know, Michaels
until 2002.
Yeah, until 2002. At the Royal Rumble, the story goes that Michaels took a backdrop over the ropes and to the outside and hit his lower back on the either on the edge of the apron or on the casket, and that was basically what put it over the top and kept him out of the ring for a few years after that.
Yeah.
But basically the whole feud for this, it started the night after the Royal Rumble when Mike Tyson came out on Raw. And Vince McMahon had this huge segment planned to announce that Tyson would be involved with WrestleMania 14. And, of course, as was the usual at the time, Stone Cold Steve Austin was having none of that. Came out to ruin Vince McMahon's moment and ended up in a little pull-apart brawl with Mike Tyson that, of course, set up Tyson to become a member of Degeneration X in the weeks prior to this match. So the deck was definitely stacked against Stone Cold in this match going into it.
But you know, as a match, you know, by the way, I loved sort of I thought Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross were excellent in this match.
Yeah.
Two, I loved the sort of pre-rumble of, you know, they show the wrestlers coming to like right outside the curtain, and they had that sort of music that sort of got the hype. It was a sort of like classic championship hype music that I really liked that they did that leading into the intros.
And also, as you mentioned, you know, whenever they showed the guys coming out of their locker rooms and into gorilla position, the staging area right before they come out, Shawn Michaels gives a shout out to Earl Hebner, who I do believe the night before WrestleMania or shortly before this WrestleMania, I think he had an aneurysm. It was either an aneurysm or a heart attack or something, but I'm assuming that Earl Hebner was to be the referee of this main event, but of course, because of those medical problems, wasn't. And so, whenever you, of course, hear Shawn Michaels before the match say, "This is for you, Earl," that was definitely something that I always remembered from it. Shawn Michaels giving that little shout-out. But of course, we had the DX band playing Shawn Michaels to the ring again.
Yep, as they did with Triple H as well.
Yes.
But, you know, it was a great match. I love the fact, I love, like, at the beginning, the sort of, like, cockiness of Michaels. Again, just really added to that story, the way he sort of danced around the ring.
Yep, he came out and he came out and basically did like a almost like a Muhammad Ali shuffle. Sort of playing up that maybe Mike Tyson had had given him a few extra little tips, a couple secret weapons to help him beat Austin at WrestleMania.
Yeah, but you know, pound for pound, it was just a great match. I love the finish. I love the counter to the counter to the counter into the finisher.
Oh, yeah.
So great finish there, but great It was my favorite match of the night. It was just, it was a classic match of the Attitude Era.
Yeah, Don,
when you
know,
think about
it. To me, it was two guys who were at the top of their game and at the top of the Federation at the time. It was, Mr. WrestleMania, as he's gone on to be known as, Shawn Michaels. Even though he was hurt at the time and, of course, had quite a lot of drug issues and things like that at the time, he still came out there and gave it 110% and put on a hell of a show.
You could see that, too. I mean, he was hurting in that match.
Oh, definitely. And there's at one point where Shawn, he gets tossed into the turnbuckle by Stone Cold and does this upside-down, almost like Ric Flair-like, flip into the turnbuckle. Man, after watching it back and knowing that, that Shawn's back was as bad as it was at the time, that was pretty brutal. Shawn took quite a few big bumps in that match. And, as that was Shawn's thing. He bounced around the ring like a pinball. He sold like no other. And as you mentioned, of course, it was a back-and-forth match. They played up the Mike Tyson being at ringside as a special enforcer, of course, being a member of D-Generation X, and the referee Mike Chioda, at one point, when Austin tried to reverse a sleeper hold, he backed up with Michaels into the turnbuckle, and referee Mike Chioda was knocked unconscious, and of course, that was the setup for the finish. Both guys were down. Shawn Michaels hits the famous kip-up, which is another amazing thing to see, considering his back was in such bad shape. He hits his signature high-flying elbow and gets in there in the corner and starts tuning up the band. And then we go into that finish you mentioned with the counter after the counter after the counter. Austin stands up. He stands up, Michaels comes out of the corner with the sweet chin music, Austin ducks, attempts the stunner on HBK, he gets thrown into the ropes by Michaels, gets met again with the second attempt at the sweet chin music, which he grabs, shakes off defiantly, shakes his head, spins Shawn Michaels around, boot to the gut, stone cold stunner. Mike Tyson jumps in the ring, of course with referee Mike Chioda still down, and made one of the quickest three counts I think I've ever seen.
you had that note too.
yes. I'm not sure if Mike was just maybe overly enthusiastic, because I know that Mike was, of course, a huge wrestling fan in his day.
He still is,
absolutely. I don't know if he was just really excited and got in there, but that was that's like the only thing I don't like about the match. I would have loved to see Tyson come in there and just give it the big 1-2-3 instead of the 1-2-3 that he did. But it all worked out all right. The crowd popped huge. The place exploded. Tyson, of course, raises the hand of Stone Cold Steve Austin, who is victorious for his first World Wrestling Federation championship. First of many, of course.
Yeah.
And then there was a little confrontation after the match with Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin. I think Shawn Michaels came to after the stunner and stood up, and he saw Mike Tyson with a Austin 316 T-shirt holding it up. Of course, singing the praises of our new champion, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and Michael stands up confused and just, what are you doing? You know, you were a part of DX, you turned your back, and Michael started putting his hands on Iron Mike, which it didn't work out too well for him, did it, Tommy?
No. As I was going to say, I mean, great into the match. I agree with you on the quick count. I mean, that's in my notes, too. I mean, it is a bit of a fast count, if you're being gracious. But, yeah, it stands up, and he goes to, you know, finally Michael says, I'm going to throw a punch at him. It gets blocked, and a quick, you know, right cross from Tyson knocks Michaels out. Lasting image of, and, of course, there's a, I love the fact that you have Austin. He's standing in the corner just watching this. And then comes out of the corner just, like, laughing his ass off.
Yep.
Great sell by Austin.
And, of course, before leaving the ring, gives one Shawn Michaels the double Stone Cold salute, the two middle fingers. And, that was our main event. And, you know, as you said, it was a hell of a match. It was back and forth. To me, the one thing that really stands out is the finish. The reversals into the reversal into the reversal, finally into the stunner. You know, that's always stuck with me. It was a great match. This served as the launching pad for the rest of 1998, 1999, even into 2000 for Stone Cold to be the man in the World Wrestling Federation at the time.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's probably my favorite match of the night. It just was really good, really solid. So with that, let's go to final ratings. What would you rate this on a scale of 1 to 5? Would of course 5 being the best, 1 being the worst? How would you rate this WrestleMania?
Well, you know, at the time I thought it was, which of course it's a little different to rate it at the time compared to now looking back. At the time, I probably would have told you it was about a 4. They had a lot of pretty hot storylines coming into it with DX, Austin, Kane and Undertaker, of course The Rock, who would go on to really take off in 1998. I would say at the time I would have called it, about a 4, 3 or 4. Looking back on it, in comparison, I'd give it a 3. The storylines were good. Some of the matches don't necessarily still stand up. Of course, the dumpster match, the light heavyweight match, Owen and Triple H, Rock Shamrock, and our main event. All those matches were great, but the other matches on the card that I didn't mention, of course, Mero and Sable, as well as the Tag Team Battle Royal, they weren't all that great. They weren't terrible, but... to me, this WrestleMania, it wasn't quite like the next year, WrestleMania 15. WrestleMania 15, to me, felt like one giant episode of Monday Night Raw. And that, in comparison, I would probably rate WrestleMania 15 about a 2, whereas I would give a card like WrestleMania 11, which is probably my least favorite of all the WrestleManias, right next to WrestleMania 2, I would give those like a 2, a 1, maybe on a good day, give them a 2. But this was a pretty run of the mill WrestleMania. The storylines were good and hot. I'd give it somewhere. Let's call it just to be difficult, a 3.5 out of 5. I would give this one. How about you? How about you?
Well, I think we're on the same wavelength here. I was going to give it a 3.5. as well. For the most part, all the matches were for the most part solid. Really only two matches that weren't that great. The Mero Sable match, again, like I said, worst match of the night, but that's a lot due to the fact that Mero and Goldust and them weren't into it. Sable really saved that match. And then the Battle Royal, while not being that good, was just a builder match. In many ways. But the rest of the matches were solid. The card was solid. It definitely felt like a WrestleMania. And as long as it feels like a WrestleMania, it can't be that bad. So it definitely had that WrestleMania feel, had that big fight feel. A lot of good, solid matches. I mean, when you're having to go, this is my fourth favorite match of the night, and the card is only 8 matches, you know, you at least have a solid at middle of the road pay-per-view there. Yeah, so
definitely. And, you know, as I said, not all the matches were great, but this WrestleMania was definitely helped by having Mike Tyson as the outside enforcer for the main event. Tyson, of course, was a hot topic at the time. He had recently had his boxing license revoked for an incident in the ring with Evander Holyfield. And,
fighting of the year.
Yeah. And, you know, really, a lot of people, from what I understand, were brought back to watching the World Wrestling Federation by the whole Mike Tyson media hoopla and circus, you know. That provided them the opportunity to see Stone Cold Steve Austin and tune in. And, you know, I think the whole Austin involvement at this, or not, excuse me, the Tyson involvement at this WrestleMania, I think it did a lot for the future, for the rest of 1998, for, like I said, launching Stone Cold to be the top guy in the company for quite a while.
I think it showed that, you know, Vince was a genius for bringing Mike Tyson in, and I don't think you can really understate how important it was for Tyson to be there, how he was able to bring so many people to the WWF at that time, and how it really helped the product.
Yeah, definitely.
It's one of those things to why he's definitely deserving of his WWE Hall of Fame ring.
Absolutely.
Now, whether he should have got it before Mr. T, this year's current inductee, I think that's a different question.
Honestly, I would much rather have Iron Mike in there than Mr. T. Mr. T definitely helped out a lot with the first WrestleMania in many ways, kind of like Iron Mike did with this one. You know, providing that outside, that hot topic celebrity involvement that was a staple of WrestleManias and still is. You know, that was their role, and of course, Mr. T ended up stepping into the ring at WrestleMania 1 and 2. But yeah, you know, I think both of those guys are at the very least somewhat deserving of their Hall of Fame standing.
They both are. I guess it's a debate with, like, would you have put Mike Tyson in before Mr. T?
I think you got to go chronologically. Mr. T was one of those key players that helped to get the first WrestleMania off the ground. So personally, I would have thrown him in there earlier than Tyson.
Yeah.
Just going off chronological order. But
yeah, well, and that's what I'm saying. That's why I pretty much agree with you on that. So
yeah.
So that is our review, 3.5 out of 5. Corey, thank you so much for coming on, man. Do you want to let people know where they can find you on the interwebs, as they're called?
Well, very fairly soon, I'm actually a musician. I'm going to be with a songwriting partner of mine, and we're going to be launching our own production company, as well as possibly a record label. We're going to be publishing our own songs for use in music. For use in movies, television, radio. Maybe even one of these days, you might hear one of my songs on WWE programming. That would be a dream come true for me. But I don't really have any information as far as that right now. We're taking care of a lot of the legal things that have to be taken care of first. But I'm sure on my next appearance, I'll have a little bit more information as to where you can find me. And check out what I'm doing. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook, Corey Wilson, C-O-R-Y, Wilson, just like the volleyball. feel free to add me. I'm always game to talk wrestling. I'm a wrestling nerd, and I love it. I don't care what anybody thinks about it. And, I definitely appreciate you having me on. It's been a blast. Pleasure was all mine, and I look forward to joining you again sometime. With best Jew in the world.
Yes, and of course, folks, remember, if you have any emails or comments, there are several ways you can email to show to let us know. Again, next week we're going to be doing WrestleMania 23, so if you want to get any comments about that WrestleMania out, Remember, there are several ways to do it. One, you can email the show at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can go to our Facebook page, which you can find by going to www.facebook.com and searching for the Absolution Network. Find us and like us there. And, of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself that you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Of course, remember to check out all the other 132 Productions content that, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum and Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network, the Shaft Plus podcast with Gene and Chris, which you can find at www.shaftplus.com. The Tokyo SOS Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my comic book crazy podcasting network featuring the newly reborn CMG Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, and Spectacular Webs podcast over at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, remember to check out all our friends on the sidebar of the site. That, of course, includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers Podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner's Two Freaks Podcasting Network. Check out all our friends. And that is it for this episode of CMZU's Wrestling Reviews. As I said, next week, we go to what I consider one of the best WrestleManias of all time, WrestleMania 23. So until next time, all my wrestling fans, just remember one goddamn thing. I'm the best show in the world!
Oh, hell yeah.
You're all that I have and you're all that I need. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you, yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the air that I feed. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around all around, I believe it, I'm too negative, I deep, but I believe, yes, I believe, I said I believe. I stand among two feet, one beat, down on one knee. I fight with all of my might to get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight unto the heights. Crown lights burning up, out of the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. I give myself to you from the essence of my being and I sing to my God. Songs of love and healing, I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be holy in a ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my being and I sing to my God. Songs of love and healing, I want Mashiach now. Stripping away the layers and reveal your soul. You gotta give yourself up and then you become whole. You're a slave to yourself and them don't even know. Them wanna live that fast life, but